Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Kindred Spirits, a romance about love, life, and the afterlife, by Whitney Dineen. Narrated by Preston Gear and Ali Rose. Important encounters are planned by souls long before the bodies see each other. Paulo Coelho. Richard Bingham. Chapter 1.
Mr. Bingham, the overtly stylish reporter from Manhattan Life magazine started, tell me what it's like to be voted one of the top 10 eligible bachelors in New York.
41-year-old Richard smiled humbly and replied, I'm not sure who did the voting, but I'm flattered to be thought of so highly. I can assure you, I'm a pretty ordinary guy.
Taking a slow sip of her latte, the reporter replied, Yes, well, I can assure you, no ordinary men made the cut.
Then coquettishly lifting her eyes from her notebook, Shelley Milton asked,
What exactly are you looking for in a woman?
Oblivious to her flirtations, Richard looked beyond her as if lost in his own thoughts. I guess I want to find someone who's unique, unpredictable, and spontaneous. Somebody who loves to have fun.
That's quite a list, she opined before asking. What does your ideal woman look like?
Richard laughed easily. That's hard to say, as I haven't met her yet, he explained. I don't have a physical type as much as a personality type.
So, she quipped, any single gal in New York has a chance with you as long as she's got a good personality? You sound too good to be true.
Shelley, I appreciate you making me seem like such a great catch, but I've got my flaws. I'm just looking for a woman who will overlook them, someone who will love me in spite of them. Touching the tip of her 4-inch high heel to Richard's leg, she inquired,
What exactly are your flaws? Because from my angle, you look darn near perfect.
Taking a sip of his French roast, Richard responded, I work too hard. I don't play enough, and I don't laugh enough. I'm hoping the right woman can change all of that. After another 30 minutes of banter, Shelley turned off her recorder and announced,
I think I have all I need to write a great piece.
After a beat, she added,
Magazine rules don't allow me to ask until our professional relationship is over, but maybe once I've written my article, we could go out to dinner sometime?
Richard was shocked and answered, That would be lovely, but isn't that an engagement ring on your finger?
Maybe, she replied coyly. But an engagement ring isn't a wedding ring, is it?
Perhaps not, but it does indicate a prior commitment. There was no way Shelley could misconstrue the judgment in his voice. She immediately knew she didn't have a chance with Richard Bingham, so she responded,
I guess it does.
Uncomfortably, Richard met her direct gaze and said, I don't mean to be rude, but once I ask a woman to marry me, I would hope she'd stop shopping around for someone better.
Mr. Bingham, the reporter icily replied, I'm sure in your case, she will, but not everyone is lucky to be engaged to a paragon like yourself. Sometimes people reach an age and place in their lives where they compromise their ideals a bit and settle for something instead of continuing on with nothing.
That's a sad commentary on single life. No one should settle for anyone less than they truly desire.
Unfortunately, she retorted, only a handful of singles are considered as desirable as you. I'm afraid life is a bit different for those of us who live in the real world.
Richard realized he'd gone too far and tried to amend his earlier statement by adding, I think you sell yourself short, Miss Milton. As far as I'm concerned, the only reason I won't have dinner with you is that you're promised to another.
Shelley responded. That's very noble of you.
Gathering her things together, she stood up and declared,
I wish you luck in your great love search, Mr. Bingham. I'm sure you'll have a better selection of potential mates than the rest of us mortals.
There was a gleam in her eye that Richard found disconcerting. For a moment, he wished he'd merely accepted her offer and reneged at a later date. Shelley Milton looked mad, determined, and offended. Not exactly the trifecta of emotions you want to leave a reporter with right before she writes an article about you in a well-respected and well-circulated magazine. When Richard got back to his office, he sorted through his mail and phone messages. He wondered why in the world a woman as attractive as the magazine reporter was engaged to a man she thought of as less than ideal. Richard had been married once to a woman he still considered a good friend. They'd been divorced for nearly 13 years, and in all that time he'd never felt the urge to rush back to the altar, until recently. In the last few months, Richard had started to feel the need for a family of his own. If he were honest, he'd admit it went beyond need and bordered on a burning desire. He was ready to enjoy the benefits of all his years of hard work. He wanted to start the next phase of his life, and all of a sudden he couldn't wait to do so. As he rifled through his inbox, he thought of the women he'd dated in the last several years. By and large, they were wealthy, successful, and beautiful. While that looked good on the surface, that's as far as it went. In reality, most of them were entitled, bored, and void of passion. Richard wanted more, and he was determined to find it. He wasn't going to be like Shelley Milton and settle for someone who wasn't perfect for him. Using his letter opener, Richard made a slit in what appeared to be an invitation. The heavy cardstock suggested it was for a wedding. Yet when he pulled the missive out of the envelope, he discovered his mistake. He wasn't holding a wedding invitation. He was holding a request to engage the services of the East Side Yenta, a well-known matchmaker in Manhattan. Richard had never considered using a matchmaker. As a rule, he was capable of getting as many dates as he wanted. It wasn't until recently that he started to question the quality of those encounters. On impulse, he filed Rachel Feynman's card away in his Rolodex. If things didn't pick up for the better, he might just have to give her a call. Richard buzzed his secretary, Gemma. Within moments, she waddled in carrying a file he'd requested. After handing it off, she dropped down on a chair opposite him and declared,
If this baby doesn't come out soon, I'm going to yank her out myself.
Richard laughed. If that were possible, I'd help you. You look downright miserable. Gemma slipped her shoes off and grumbled.
Richard, if it was up to men to carry the babies, the world's population wouldn't be half of what it is today.
He agreed. I'd be way less inclined to have 7 children if I had to do the incubating.
What I want to know is why are you still coming into the office and not starting your maternity leave now?
He added.
I already told you to take as much time as you needed and not worry about your paycheck. While I think it's very decent of you to continue to pay me while I abandon you for an undisclosed amount of time, I already told you. You'd never survive without me, and my replacement can't start until next week.
Richard laughed. How in the world do you think I survived before you? I promise I won't ruin all your hard work in a week's time. His secretary retorted,
Of course you will. The problem with you, Richard, is that you're successful because you're so darn charming. The problem with order is that it doesn't care how charismatic and dreamy you are. It requires the steel hand of organization, which is what I bring to the mix.
Ah, Gemma, Richard teased.
How did I wind up not marrying you?
You're the perfect bossy woman who tells it like it is. We would have made beautiful children together.
Yeah, well, You snooze, you lose, Daddy Warbucks. Plus, you're too dashing and debonair for my taste. I like a good beer-drinking man who can burp the alphabet.
Then she doubled over in a cramp and declared,
Crap! I think my water just broke.
While Richard grabbed the phone to have a car brought around to take his secretary and friend to the hospital, he thought about how much he looked forward to the day his wife would go into labor with his child. Of course, he had to meet his wife first, which was becoming more problematic than he'd originally anticipated. Dating in New York. Chapter 2. Richard Bingham gazed attentively at the woman sitting across the table from him. For all intents and purposes, she'd make the perfect mate. She was a businesswoman in her own right, so she wasn't interested in him solely for his money. She was successful, beautiful, and an engaging conversationalist. She was 34, blonde, and very feminine. Her name was Amanda. Richard knew picking a wife after only 3 dates was jumping the gun a bit, but he was itching to get on with the next phase of his life. So he'd set a certain criteria for the women he dated in order to expedite his goal of matrimony. The first date's agenda was to find out as much about her family life as possible in order to evaluate whether she would make a suitable spouse and mother. Date 2 was all about discovering her desire for a family and how many children she envisioned having. Was she planning to continue her career after becoming a mother and have a nanny raise her offspring? Or did she intend to quit her job and be a full-time parent? Many women exited Richard's life at this point. He wanted a mate who longed for a home life more than career success. He didn't care if his wife worked. He just didn't want her to be married to her job, only offering him and their children whatever time she had left. Richard understood his thinking was considered archaic, but family was important to him, and he wanted his offspring to have very involved parents. Something he'd only had one of. He intended to cut his work down to the bare minimum as well, by only staying on the board of directors of his company. He would appoint a new CEO when his first child arrived, so he could spend most of his time at home. Date 3 was dedicated to exploring physical chemistry. While this didn't necessarily mean going to bed with the woman, it did mean kissing and other pleasantries. After all, if a strong attraction didn't exist, there was no point moving forward. Richard owned one of the largest advertising firms in New York City. He was also the epitome of tall, dark, and handsome. He'd made his fortune and was ready to enjoy it. Unfortunately, once Shelley Milton's article in Manhattan Life magazine came out, he'd become the target of an enormous number of fortune hunters. Shelley did not take his lack of interest lying down. Instead, she transferred her anger into her article, writing that Richard was desperate to find a mate, and any and all women's attentions would be welcome. She made it sound like he was going to pick a wife soon, so interested parties should take their bid tout de suite. The overall tone of the piece was akin to a reality dating show. In a word, it was tawdry. The hopeful candidates came in all ages, shapes, and sizes. They either stalked Richard outright and approached him directly, or tried to make their meeting appear accidental, like bumping into him while he waited for the barista to make his coffee. Others attempted to secure introductions through friends or business associates. The onslaught of attention was making Richard feel like a fox at the hunt. He started to think he should have never agreed to be interviewed for the magazine. By turning down Shelley, he'd started a chain of events that was turning into a nightmare. The avalanche of interest was making it awkward to go out in public without women throwing themselves at him, which of course made meeting a nice, normal woman almost an impossible feat. Not only had the hostess at the restaurant he was dining at with Amanda slipped him a note with her name, number, and Facebook handle on it, but another woman sitting at a nearby table had stopped by to introduce herself and tell Richard that if his date didn't work out, she'd be interested in meeting up with him later that night. Richard Bingham was starting to feel sorry for rock stars. Imagine being one of the Rolling Stones back in the day. He used to think they had it made, but was now realizing their fame might not have been all it was cracked up to be. No wonder they did so many drugs. Amanda offered him a bite of halibut, and when he reached out to take her fork, she snapped.
"My God, Richard, you can't use my fork. That's positively unhygienic."
Richard pulled his hand back and forced an uncomfortable laugh. "I was hoping we might be getting close enough to think sharing a fork was romantic." He apologized. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to move too quickly." His date turned red in embarrassment, and some other emotion Richard couldn't seem to place. Although, if forced to guess, he might deduce it was revulsion. He offered, "Amanda, if you're not attracted to me, you should just tell me. We could always move our relationship into the friendship zone." Richard had no intention of doing any such thing. He wasn't in the market for more friends, but he wasn't going to tell his date that. Better he find out what her real feelings were and take it from there. Amanda took a fortifying sip of wine before saying,
"I have a thing about saliva and other bodily fluids," she confessed. "I don't like them."
Richard wasn't quite sure how to respond. In his estimation, the whole intimate side of a relationship would be adversely affected if one of the partners had an aversion to bodily fluids. So he boldly inquired, "Do you enjoy kissing, Amanda?" With her eyes averted, she responded,
"Not particularly. I don't mind being pecked on the cheek, however. Very few germs are transmitted that way."
Then she offered,
"Richard, I like you, and I can see a future with you. I'd like to be married someday and have a family. And just so you know, I wouldn't expect my husband to be faithful. In fact, he could have as many liaisons as he wanted, as long as he was discreet."
Richard started to wonder if there was a non-gold-digging, non-social-climbing, non-mentally unstable woman left in the Big Apple. He was starting to think he actually would need to hire a matchmaker in order to find a life partner. He explained to Amanda they clearly had different ideas of what marriage entailed, and thanked her for the 3 dates. Then he paid the check, dropped her off at her apartment, and went home to pour himself a stiff drink, one substantial enough to drown his sorrows in.
"You did what?" Spencer Hollis demanded.
Richard replied, "I told you, Spence. I made an appointment with the Eastside Yenta."
"Richard, you are one of, if not the, most eligible bachelors in New York City. Why in the world do you need the help of some old Jewish matchmaker? You're not even Jewish," he added.
"For God's sake, Spencer, you don't have to be Jewish to use a matchmaker. I'm using her because ever since the article in Manhattan Life magazine came out, I've managed to attract every freak show gold digger east of the Mississippi. Seriously, the one I went out with last week has an aversion to sex." Shaking his head in exasperation, he added, "Clearly, I've reached the point where I need professional help."
Richard's college friend responded, "You just need to start hanging out in those clubs downtown where all the models go. You'll have the perfect little missus lined up in no time."
Says the man who's already married and divorced 3 of those models. "No thanks, buddy. I'm looking for my soulmate. I want someone to spend the rest of my life with, not someone to pay alimony to for the rest of her life."
Spencer snorted. "Happily ever after isn't real, my friend. You need to set your sights on happy for right now and live in the moment, man."
"I've already had one marriage go south, Spence. Luckily, Amelia and I split amicably. But I don't want any more exes. I want a future. And I'm a firm believer in happily ever after, even if you aren't."
"I'm going with you then," Spencer declared. I'm not letting you put your future happiness in the hands of some toothless old-world hag with hairy knuckles and a limp without some input from the master."
Richard shook his head.
"Toothless hag with hairy knuckles and a limp? Spencer, you have no idea what you're talking about. Rachel Fineman is the exact opposite of what you're imagining. In fact, I think you should come with me. I also think you should sign up for her services for yourself. It's past time that you associate with a better class of women."
His friend scoffed.
"Oh, I'm coming with you, all right, but not going to sign up. I'm coming to make sure the old hag knows exactly the kind of gal you need."
He made an exaggerated hourglass gesture with his hands.
3 days later, Richard waited for his appointment in an elegantly appointed silvery gray waiting room with a pristine view of the Empire State Building. Spencer flipped through books full of women's profiles like he was a kid in a candy store.
"Look at this one! Yowza, Richie! I think you might be onto something with this matchmaker thing after all."
Richard rolled his eyes. "Spencer, every person who signs up with Rachel is looking for a life partner. This isn't a place for a cheap fling, so keep your pants on."
"I'm just saying that if you're set on getting married, there are some pretty fine fillies in this stable."
Punctuating his comment with a pelvic thrust and eyebrow shrug, he added,
"You know what I mean?"
"You're a pig, Spence. Seriously, the only reason you're still my friend is that we're the same blood type and I might need a kidney someday."
Spencer laughed in response.
"Or I might need a kidney."
At that moment, a curvaceously slender woman approached them. She had long, dark hair that was pulled back in a sleek chignon, and she was wearing a form-fitting black business suit with a suggestively cut white silk blouse. With a smile, she greeted,
"Richard, I'm so glad you finally decided to pay me a visit."
With a glance at Spencer, she added,
"And you've brought reinforcements."
Spencer jumped to his feet and immediately tripped over one of them as he stepped forward to offer Rachel his hand. Smiling at his clumsiness, she asked,
"Are you here looking for love too?"
Spencer, who would normally turn a question like that into a lascivious proposition, could barely manage a response of,
I'm just here to offer support," he stammered. "For you know, Richard here."
Rachel gave her new client a slide glance, as if to question his association with a bumbling fool like Spencer. Richard missed it entirely, as he was thoroughly distracted by his friend's inability to speak coherently. The real Spencer was slick to the point of being disgusting, but this guy was acting as awkward as a 15-year-old right before his first kiss. Richard dragged Spencer by the arm and followed his matchmaker down a long hallway to her office. The men sat in side-by-side wing-backed leather chairs as Rachel got comfortable at a mahogany desk directly across from them. Shuffling through a stack of papers, she started,
"As I mentioned, Richard, I definitely think you should look for someone in her 30s. While many men your age are drawn to younger women, I think your chances of finding a quality partner are greater amongst those who have already found their own identity."
She added,
"That's more typical in older women."
Finding his voice, Spencer interjected,
"As long as you know that Richard isn't looking for a gold-digging bimbo, he actually wants to settle down for the long haul."
"Mr.—"
Rachel didn't know Spencer's name, so she merely waited for him to fill in the blank.
"Spencer Hollis," he replied.
"Mr. Hollis," she began, "all kinds of people sign up for my services. I can't personally vouch for the character of any of them, as I only know what they tell me. While there are a lot of men who are more than happy to marry a gold-digging bimbo, and there are a lot of air-headed pie-in-the-sky bimbos to go around, your friend has asked for a quality person with whom he can share his life. My advice to him will be based purely on his desires."
Properly chastised, if not a little afraid,
Spencer sat quietly through the rest of the meeting. Richard finished answering all of Rachel's questions and filled out an in-depth questionnaire. 2 hours later, he was more optimistic about the future than he'd been in years.
Philippa Fielding, Chapter 3. 8-year-old Pip prayed. God, thank you for letting me live, but I'd really like to see my angel again. She implored. If you could arrange that, I'd be most grateful. To the casual observer, Philippa Fielding had the perfect life. Born to the British aristocracy, she lived between the family home in the Knightsbridge district of London and the Earl's family seat in the Derbyshire countryside. Her upbringing was as privileged as they came. She'd nary a care in the world, or so it seemed to the casual observer. The problem with appearances, though, is they can be deceiving. As a young girl, Pip contracted rheumatic fever, which left her with a temperature that raged unchecked for days. Her doctors weren't optimistic she'd survive without lasting brain damage. Her parents and brother were devastated. Her family prayed their hearts out that she would live, no matter the consequences. Pip's first real memory, not the flitting impression-only kind, but rather full-fledged recollection, was during this time. She remembered sitting up in her hospital bed and stepping right out of her body as her family sobbed beside her. She recalled thinking how strange it was that they didn't notice as she walked around them. She tried to touch them and hug them, but her arm slipped right through as if she were a ghost. She tried talking to them, but they didn't hear her. Eventually, she just floated to the back of the room as though she were no more than an untethered ship cast adrift on an open sea. That was when a beautifully ethereal being, surrounded entirely in a shimmering white light, stepped through the wall and joined her. Pip was sure she was an angel, even though she'd never actually seen one in person. The woman introduced herself as Corrine and told Pip she could get her back into her body if she wanted to. She explained that Pip could stay on Earth with her family as long as she was willing to help Corrine once in a while. Pip not only wanted to live, she definitely wanted to see the lovely angel again. As far as she was concerned, the deal encompassed the best of both worlds. She didn't ask Corrine what kind of help she'd want, she simply agreed. In that very instant, Pip was drawn quickly back into her form, leaving her feeling like she'd been sucked through one of those crazy curly straws. Pip's fever left that day, and her recovery was speedy. Yet she didn't tear a peep from Corrine and started to think she'd imagined the whole encounter. 6 weeks passed and still nothing. Finally, one night during her evening prayers, Pip begged God to let her see her angel again. The next afternoon, the children were having tea in the garden with their nanny, Mrs. Hedgegrove, when Corrine glided right through the wisteria and sailed over to them. Pip jumped up, almost overturning her cup, and exclaimed, "Corrine, you came! You're finally here!" She turned to her brother and nanny and announced, "This is my friend, the one who helped me live." Since Elliot and the nanny couldn't see Corrine, they came to the dreaded conclusion the youngest Fielding really was brain damaged and hadn't come out of sickness as unscathed as they'd previously assumed. They immediately shared the news with the elder Fieldings, and Pip's fate, as a mentally unstable person, was sealed. Dating in London, Chapter 4. Philippa was racing down the stairs of the Knightsbridge tube station when Corrine materialized next to her. She hadn't seen her friend in ages, as she'd recently been pawned off on yet another.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?